It was supposed to be a simple diplomatic trip to some of the poorest countries in Africa.
The time for action is now. We're not waiting anymore.
2 weeks ago, Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, went to talk at a camp for refugees, people who'd been displaced by the civil war in South Sudan. And then this happened. The crowds of protesters were so angry and so big, and they would not be talked down, and so the ambassador had to be evacuated, and police with tear gas were called in to disperse the crowds.
Here's what they're so angry about. South Sudan has 4 million people who cannot return to their homes, even though the civil war in South Sudan is basically over, the fighting has subsided, but peace has not come. All you have are these peace talks that drag on year after year after year.
South Sudan and the United States have a very special relationship. South Sudan is a country in large part because of support that it got from the United States when it decided to break off from Sudan, which is its neighbor to the north. South Sudanese pushed to become a country for years, and meanwhile here in the U.S., celebrities kind of glommed on to this cause.
Right now we're standing here on the border of Chad and Darfur. A lot of bad things are happening over here right now.
George Clooney went to South Sudan and did this video diary with his father.
We started in South Sudan. We heard there were a lot of refugees pouring south. We found a village called Jacques with over 1,000 displaced families.
South Sudan finally became a country in the summer of 2011.
I'm very happy and I thank God for this day. I'm sending good luck to all the South Sudanese.
And America sent money. Since that Independence Day, the U.S. has put $5 billion just in humanitarian aid and development.
And that is one big reason that Nikki Haley was in South Sudan. She and the Trump administration have threatened to cut budgets for U.N. peacekeeping missions. They say these long, drawn-out conflicts like the one in South Sudan need to be resolved more quickly. They are just too expensive.
But there's a different way of thinking about the conflict going on in South Sudan or what it'll take to finally end it. It took me years of going to South Sudan myself to even see this thing. And the reason it took me so long to understand it is because I had to kind of rethink what is money. Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Gregory Warner.
And I'm Noelle King. And Gregory, you're taking a break from your own podcast, Rough Translation, to tell us a story.
That's right. On the Rough Translation podcast, we look at how the things we're talking about in the United States are being talked about somewhere else in the world. Today, I have a story about a country that is out of war but still can't find peace, and what that all has to do with this ancient form of currency.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Slack. For companies all over the world, from the very small to the very large, Slack is where work happens. Create a team in minutes and get everyone on board. Slack gives you one manageable space in which to gather all the people you need to talk to, all the projects you need to keep tabs on, and with more than 1,000 apps seamlessly integrating with Slack, all the tools you need to get things done. Find out more at slack.com.
Before we get to the war story, let's start with a love story.
Yeah.
I met this guy, Gabriel Gatkoth, in South Sudan. He was telling me about how he fell in love in college in Nairobi, Kenya, with a fellow student.
We grew up together in Nairobi.
And when they decided to get married, her father said, "No way, not until you pay me."
Which is a very common thing in South Sudan. It's called a bride price. It's like a dowry. I actually worked in and out of South Sudan for a couple of years, and I was always very impressed with this system.
Did you go to a lot of weddings when
I
you were
did. There? So many.
But the thing about that dowry that Gabriel had to pay is he could not pay it in cash.
When I marry, I paid cows.
The South Sudan accent sometimes swaps P's for F's. He's saying he paid cows. Do you mind if I ask how many cows you paid?
I was told to feed 85 cows.
85 cows? You must have a great life.
My wife is educated.
Her college education increases the price. So the base price for a dowry would be 15 to 18 cows, but if the bride is educated, you got to triple that. If she lives abroad, as she and Gabriel do in Kenya, then double that again. There's a discount because they're actually in love. And the total, 85 cows, that was worth in 2012 about $14,000.
Yeah, we knew it was right for me to pay the 85 cows. Mm. but I have to comply.
Gabriel does not have any cows himself, so he hits up his family. Goes to his dad, his uncle, his third cousin, finally amasses 65 cows, 20 short.
I have a balance of 20 that I need to clear in future.
But fortunately, his father-in-law accepted an IOU for the other 20 cows, and the wedding goes forth. But that debt, Gabriel definitely plans to pay. It's going to take a few years, but, you know, cows have babies. But then something happens that's going to change not only Gabriel's life, but actually this whole cow system.
Now to the world's youngest nation, South Sudan. NPR's Gregory Warner is in the South Sudan capital, Juba. And Gregory, the fighting erupted in Juba a little more than a week ago. What is the situation like there now?
You know, Robert, it's strange to describe because it's very quiet.
So this is when I arrived to South Sudan as a reporter in December of 2013. I was the East Africa correspondent at the time. And what had happened was that the president and the vice president hated each other. And this fight between these two men triggered a much bigger fight.
Gregory, I was reporting from South Sudan 8 years before you were there. Mm-hmm. And the same rivalry was happening then, too. Each of these men has his own little army, his own militia, and they're divided along ethnic lines.
These divisions have gone back decades, with the difference now that when I was there, South Sudan was its own country. It had its own government, its own oil wealth, and this scramble for power got a lot more deadly. So you have militias attacking civilians from other ethnic groups, not only killing men as before, but now targeting women, children, small babies. People were fleeing, and the place they're ending up are these camps run by the United Nations.
Yeah!
Gabriel, the college student, takes me into one of these camps. We've come to talk to villagers about the war, about the atrocities. But the thing that they seem to want to talk most about is the fact that these rampaging militias also stole their cows.
So who here has lost cows?
All of them. Gabriel and I start talking to this one man, John Gajal.
My name is John Gajal.
John Gajal.
John Gajal. Mm-hmm. He's 54, a grandfather. And am I allowed to ask how many cows you got stolen?
Okay, I know my husband
He had 80 cows.
80 cows. At this point, a crowd of kids has followed us into the shade of the tent where we're talking. And John Gajal is telling me this terrifying story of how, he says, a government militia attacked his village in the middle of the night, burning everything to the ground. John hides out in a swamp. They're actually shooting at the swamp, but John escapes and he flees on foot 80, 100 miles and ends up at this UN camp. And then he says that sometime after he arrived at this UN safe haven, he's looking out the barbed wire fence and he sees a herd of cows going by. And one of these cows he recognizes. It's his bull, a white castrated bull with a beard, he says. And so, sorry, this is a silly question from an American, but how do you know that that white castrated bull with the beard was your castrated bull with the beard? John explains, actually, he puts all these markings in the horns and he had a particular bell in the beard, so he's sure that was his bull.
He's saying, for instance, now, if I steal your t-shirt now and tomorrow you see me wearing it, what will come to your mind?
Actually, I think John would have an easier time recognizing his bull than I might remember my t-shirt. Mostly because South Sudanese really care about their cows. They name children after cows. They sing songs to their favorite bulls. People also just like to talk about cows.
There's no way somebody will go for 10 minutes without mentioning a cow or a color of a cow.
This is Machan Loy, a friend of Gabriel, the college student who got married. And Machan says that cows are not just used for dowries. Actually, anytime you have a big purchase, so if you want to buy a house or if you happen to murder somebody, a customary court judge will not send you to jail, not sentence you to prison. He will order you to pay cows.
You kill somebody and the customary law court says you have to give like 5 pregnant cows. If you give less than that, people will not accept. You have to give a pregnant cow.
Do you have cows?
No.
I've married, I've given some of them for marriages. Maybe I have one or two.
Michienne kind of looks away and gives this nervous laugh. And I realize, what have I just asked him?
By the way, in our society, we don't talk about the number of cows you have. We don't mention them.
I see. It's like asking your bank account.
Yeah, it's like asking bank account, but that is like...
Cows are like your bank account. And this actually makes a lot of sense in South Sudan because the banks themselves are really unreliable. They go bankrupt. There's big problems with currency inflation.
And the country is extremely rural with a very volatile climate. So one month it's drought and then the next it's flooding. And there's also the war, fighting. Cows have the advantage that you can run with them to safety. You can also drink their milk. And if you need a bit more protein, Michienne says that you don't have to kill the cow. There's another option. You just grab your knife and
punch a vein at the neck of a cow, and that blood is cooked, and people can eat it instead of killing the whole cow.
Yeah, they make it into kind of a blood sausage.
Which, if you think about cows as a bank account, then it's like kind of living off the interest of your savings account without dipping into the principal. In fact, South Sudanese try really hard to not have to kill their cows. They're valued so much.
They are handled with care. And you know, our every cow, whether it's old or young, it represents a certain value. You don't kill them. You kill them if there is an important situation. It's not very easy to kill a cow.
So if you think about John Guy Jal's white castrated bull with the beard, that not only represents all of his wealth, all of his savings, but also his ability to buy big things, to make large purchases, his ability to get his sons married off, and now all of that is gone.
And how do you imagine your future without cows?
I can imagine I will lead a terrible life. Life without cows is like there's no life.
If he could get his 80 cows back, or even just some of those cows, and if he could have peace or enough protection from cattle raiders in the future, he could walk out of this camp tomorrow.
But if he doesn't have cows, he is going to be stuck in this UN camp for who knows how long. For John, there's a thin line between total dependency and self-reliance.
After I left the tent talking to John Guy Jal, Gabriel wanted to show me the rest of this camp.
They're pumping water out.
I remember the beginning of this war when these camps were nothing. They were just an airfield and these barren strips of land, no sanitation, no shelter. And now it's been a couple of years into the war, so these camps have been built up by the UN and by charitable organizations. In fact, there's literally tractors carving streets and building corrugated tin shacks. There's kind of a market going on.
And what's this they're selling? Is this sugar?
Yeah, sugar.
Sugar, flour, juice, and flip-flops.
People tell me they wouldn't need all of this charity, all this international aid, if they could just get their cows back. So I started to wonder, where are those cows now? Where did they go to? And in the camp, you hear all these rumors. Some say that the cows have been driven north to Sudan or east to Ethiopia and sold, slaughtered. They're gone for good. But I found out that a lot of these cows have not left the country.
Yes, the animals have moved to areas where they usually don't move to. Yeah.
This is Sylvester.
My name is Sylvester Okoth.
He has seen those cows firsthand because actually the cattle raiders asked him to come visit.
We are vets, and we talk veterinary.
Right.
Yeah.
As a vet, he is dealing with a totally different side of this massive cow theft. Suddenly, all these stolen cows, instead of being spread out in different places around the country, each with its own little, patch of grass, suddenly all of these cows are just clustered together in these massive cow herds in the same little area.
You'll find a river which is flowing. Herds and herds of animals come in, and in a week or two, the river is not flowing anymore.
It's dry?
Yes.
Because the cows drank it?
Yes. That's how dramatic it is.
And Sylvester tells me also how sick a lot of these cows are. He's seen whole herds that are just emaciated and drooling with something called foot and mouth disease because they are living in these overcrowded conditions.
Yeah, you find diseases at levels which you are not prepared for.
Sylvester knows where the stolen cows are, but that doesn't mean he can return them to their owners. And right now, the government and rebel forces are in the middle of yet another round of peace talks. They're going to resume in December.
But these peace talks, they're not talking about cows. They're talking about stuff like power sharing and what is a timeline for elections and which ethnic group will control which ministry.
And when I was talking to people in the UN camps, nobody thinks that they're going to get their cows back through these peace talks. They say that the politicians that are sitting around the negotiating table are the very ones who stole their cows. But at the same time, nobody thinks that there can be any real peace without cows.
You tell them, guys, what will it take for us to have reconciliation?
So Machien Loy, he's the guy who told me a lot about cow life in South Sudan, he talks to people about what it will take to make peace.
People will look at you. What are we reconciling about? How can a man with our two arms, with our two legs, negotiate with somebody with two legs and two arms? You know? He has cows, we don't have cows. He burns our huts, he's building new huts. You know, he killed my parents. His parents are now living and sleeping in an air-conditioned place. So people are saying, you know, when you talk about dialogue and reconciliation, it doesn't make sense, you know. You cannot reconcile an unequal people.
Reconciliation after a brutal war is one of the hardest things there is. This is a really big part of South Sudan's history. You know, I was there a decade ago covering an entirely different conflict and an entirely different attempt at reconciliation, but one that looked remarkably similar. You know, and the U.S. was involved and the U.N. was involved. All these Western powers were involved.
And I will say one other ingredient that's often involved in successful reconciliations in South Sudan is the sacrifice of a cow. There's songs about this. There's a famous peace agreement in 1999, which was celebrated with the sacrifice of a very beautiful cow, I'm told. And when I was in the UN camp, I was asking people, hey, do you remember this song? I wanted to hear it for myself. And finally, this one village chief stepped forward and he said, well, I got a song for you.
And we'll play that after the break.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Google Home. For getting a handle on your busy mornings, just say, hey, Google, good morning. And Google Home will tell you about your first meeting, traffic on your commute, and even play you this podcast. It's a little help at home, like only Google can.
So I had been in this UN camp, and I had been asking people if they knew this song.
There's a song about the peace. Oh. It's a famous song about killing one cow to make peace.
And this village chief steps forward, okay. Santino Getdep, and he sings me this song.
Return back to the peace talk to UNDP, United Nations.
As I'm listening to this song, I realize, wait.
Return back to the peace talk to UNDP, United.
This song is not about a cow.
Let go back.
He's singing it to the United Nations.
United Nations.
Actually, to a specific UN worker. He's telling her, please help me go back home. Because, you know, cows, they're not in this camp, and there's no cows at home. So, cows, they're not in this song either.
When you come to my location, you find love. Return back to the peace talk.
We always love to hear from you, what you think of the show, what stories you want us to cover. So send us an email. We're planetmoney@npr.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Today's show was produced by Jess Jang. Thank you, Jess.
Special thanks to Naomi Pendle at the London School of Economics for many conversations about the economy of cows in South Sudan, the economy. There, I said it. Planet Money's editor is Brian Erstadt. The supervising producer is Alex Goldmark.
And if you're looking for something else to listen to, can I suggest Gregory's show, Rough Translation? It is a really wonderful podcast, stories from correspondents around the world that give us a new perspective on things that are going on here in the U.S. It somehow manages to make the world bigger and smaller all at once. Highly recommend Rough Translation.
Find it at npr.org/roughtranslation. I'm Gregory Warner.
And I'm Noelle King. Thanks for listening.
I love you very much. You are beautiful girl. What you mean, good love, I will talk to you. Return back to whom the peace talk to UNDP, United Nations.